Welcome to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. I'm Dr. Kate Staveley, a GP from Somerset, and today I'm joined by my friend and colleague,
Dr. Peter Bagshaw, also a GP in Somerset, and for this edition, also expert by experience, unfortunately.
Yes. So, Peter, I gather you've had rather a stormy time of it recently, and I think today we're going to be talking about sepsis. And I would be really interested to hear what has happened to you recently.
Thank you, Kay. Yes, well, it was all a bit dramatic. We, like everybody else, we had this sort of respiratory virus over Christmas, and it didn't go away. And, you know, all the story in the news was, it's just a respiratory virus, don't do anything. And I carried on coughing, didn't feel particularly unwell. And then suddenly I developed rigors. And for our non-medical
rigors, people, for the benefit of our audience, what are rigors?
Yeah, so I was just about to unpack that, having used a medical term. So that's where you get uncontrollable shaking of the arms and legs. And I've only actually seen it professionally once in somebody with cerebral malaria. And to experience it yourself was quite dramatic. And at that stage, I thought, oh, this isn't good. So I got up, I was in bed, I got up and collapsed on the floor. Phoned my wife, who immediately took me to our local minor injury unit, who were absolutely brilliant. You know, the name is in the title. They're meant to deal with minor injuries, but they recognized that it was sepsis straight away. They found my pulse was 130, blood pressure 70 over 50, sats of less than 90, and they gave me intravenous antibiotics, fluids, paracetamol, 999 ambulance, which was probably life-saving. Because by the time I made it to hospital an hour later, because we're out in the sticks, things were relatively stable, though I had at that stage gone into kidney failure and liver failure, and apparently went from grey to yellow over the next few days.
Goodness me. And of course, it's so important that we identify sepsis early, isn't it? Because sepsis is, although it's not common, it's one of the commonest illnesses that can result in death amongst all people. And if it's treated early enough, as it was in your case, you can have a complete full recovery. But other people are not quite so fortunate, are they?
No, absolutely. And I think, although I've been trained, as you have, to know that it happens quickly, I was absolutely knocked over by just how quickly you can go from feeling really pretty okay to being close to death. It you know, within half an hour, it was scary that it happened that quickly. And you're right, I was reading earlier that sepsis actually kills more people than cancer.
Yes,
but it's very under-recognized by both the public and sadly by us professionals, isn't it?
Absolutely. And although it can be picked up, if it's picked up early, it can be treated completely effectively. If it's not treated, and there are certain groups that are more prone to getting sepsis and it not being recognised, then it can be quite catastrophic. I think sepsis can affect every age group, if I'm right in thinking, but you're more likely to get sepsis if you're under the age of one or over the age of 65, or if you have a long-term medical condition like diabetes, or you are immunocompromised. So immunocompromised means your immune system doesn't work very well for some reason. So people may be taking medication to affect their immune system if they've got an autoimmune condition, or they may just not have a very good immune system because they've got cancer or some other background problem.
I think that's great. And maybe it'd be worthwhile going into those groups in a bit more detail, Kate. So, and the problem is it's so hard to recognize. You can have this life-threatening condition with minimal symptoms. So I don't know if you were taught it. I was taught any baby under 3 months with a fever, you should suspect sepsis and admit 999.
And I think when we qualified, that was probably the case. I think nowadays, the management of people in communities become much more sophisticated. We have all sorts of scoring systems that help us to identify people that are probably at risk of sepsis. So from a medical professional's point of view, there are things like the NEWS score, which is a scoring system we use for adults, which included as you pointed out in your own story, pulse, how fast you're breathing, what your oxygen levels are, and what your blood pressure is. And of course, skin colour is very important. So people who look very pale or blue, people who have cold extremities, and confusion. I'm getting confused here, but I'm trying to remember what all the signs are. So that's in adults, the new score. And it's fairly easy to apply, but there is also an element needed of people being suspicious. And as you said, when we first qualified, we were told to be suspicious of any child under 3 months. And I think sometimes we allow those score systems to override our natural clinical instinct, don't we? And that's when people run into difficulties and when we don't spot really ill patients.
Absolutely. And the confusion thing is particularly interesting. As you know, my one of my areas of interest is dementia. And although it's not quite the same, increased confusion in somebody with dementia usually is an infection and should be treated as a medical emergency. So, and that can be the only symptom of infection, is that somebody is just that little bit more confused.
Yes. And of course, my area of interest, which is children, it can be incredibly difficult to spot ill children, because children always have viruses, snotty noses, or a bit unwell, a rash, and there's a whole host of childhood illnesses that they'll catch. And it's very difficult to tease out those children that are unwell with sepsis from children who have run-of-the-mill normal infections. Mm. And so going back to that scoring system, I think there's a scoring system specifically for children, which is called the PEWS scoring system. And that again relies on pulse and skin color, and by skin color I mean whether or not you're pale, not what your ethnicity is, because of course we know it's difficult to recognize pallor in people who have black or brown skin, and so there you have to look at their hands or the inside of their arms to be able to get a feeling whether or not they're pale.
And there have also been some queries over the pulse oximeters that we use in people of darker skin, haven't there, that they may be less accurate there as well.
So pulse oximeters are those little devices that get put on the end of your finger and measure what your blood oxygen levels are. And they're pretty accurate, and unless you, for some reason, your peripheral circulation, so that's the blood going down to your hand, is affected. So if you're very cold, that will drop your peripheral sats. Or if you have dark skin colour, again, that can affect your peripheral sats. So there's all sorts of factors coming into play that make it very difficult to identify people with sepsis early. So what would you say, Peter, to the general public? What should they be doing if they're worried they or a loved one might have sepsis?
Well, I think the main message would be not to be afraid of false alarms, because if people are a little confused, that could be anything at all. But if it's sepsis and you don't dial 999 or contact your GP immediately, that could be the difference between life and death. It's a genuine medical emergency, in exactly the same way that somebody with crushing central chest pain is a medical emergency. So although the messaging is don't bother the doctor, most things are a virus, and I guess I was kind of myself as a professional slightly deluded by that, because I thought, oh, well, everybody's got this triple pandemic that's going around. It'll just get better by itself. And I maybe should have pressed the panic button sooner than I did, rather than wait for the rigors to kick in.
And what would you think would be the best way of pressing the panic button? Because we've got a whole range of services now that are meant to help you during the day and at night. So you have 111, 999, your GP service, urgent care centres. You went to the minor injuries unit, A&E. Where do you think is the best place for someone to contact or go or speak to somebody if they're concerned about sepsis?
I think that's a difficult thing to answer, because it'll depend so much on where you live and what your local services are. So if I had been living in the centre of a city, I'd have dialed 999. But I know that where I am, it'll take sometimes 40 minutes for the ambulance to reach me. So that didn't seem sensible. Likewise, some people have great access to their GP surgery and emergency slots available. Other people, it's really difficult to get a GP appointment. What I would say is that whichever route you choose, and to me, it should be either 999 or A&E if you're close to A&E, or your GP if you could be seen within the next half an hour. You should always say suspected sepsis. And for ambulances, that will trigger the highest level of response, won't it?
Yes, that's very true. It's quite interesting. In preparation for this chat, I had a look on the UK sepsis site, which is certainly worth exploring. And on there, there are some stories about different people who've experienced sepsis. And there's some really sad stories, particularly around children who were unwell and whose parents kept taking them back to A&E, and they kept getting turned away as, oh, it's just chicken pox, it's just a virus infection. So I think one thing I would say is trust your instinct. If you are worried about sepsis, and particularly if you're worried about sepsis in your child, and the healthcare professional doesn't seem too concerned, don't just assume that you're okay. If you're still concerned, ask for a second opinion. And there's a new law coming out now, isn't there? I think it's Martha's Law, where everybody's entitled to ask for a second opinion if they're worried about their child who's unwell. And don't worry about getting a reputation for being a nuisance. It's far more important that we recognise a case of sepsis and treat it early. You don't want to die of ignorance, as it were.
Absolutely. And sadly, I've had things like that happen in surgeries I've worked in, where people have been discharged from A&E. That, I don't want to get into blaming. I mean,
oh, no,
I don't know about you, Kate. For me, recognising sepsis is one of the most difficult roles of being a GP. It can be so vague, so difficult to spot. So it's so easy to write these newspaper headlines saying, you know, patient ignored, died of disease. And it's not like that, is it?
No. And I think the important thing is not to go blaming individuals what happens, but recognizing that the system is very complicated, and that if you're worried as a patient, you're entitled to keep raising your concerns, because, as you say, it's very difficult to spot, and you can't rely just on one clinician at one point of time to get it absolutely right. Having said that, the majority of people who are unwell with temperatures, and children with temperatures, it is a minor illness. It's nothing severe. So it's really hard to get the balance spot on there, isn't it?
Absolutely. And David has pointed out in our chat, our producer, editor, and the driving force behind this podcast, that maybe we should just take a step back and look at what sepsis is. And as you say, the difference between somebody who gets an infection and a fever and it recovers, and somebody who gets an infection and a fever and it turns to sepsis. So do we know, you've mentioned certain groups are more vulnerable to things turning to sepsis. Do you want to say a little bit?
It's important to recognise that sepsis is actually your body's response to an infection rather than a specific infection. So you can't catch sepsis from someone else who has sepsis. But somebody who has, and it can be any form of infection, but bacterial infections are by far the commonest cause of sepsis. So if, for instance, you have a pneumonia with bacteria, and it then gets into your bloodstream, and your body's response to that infection is sepsis, it affects the blood supply to all your organs, it drops the oxygen levels, your heart's output is reduced, and that causes damage to your system. So it's very important. You can't catch sepsis from someone who's got sepsis. It's your body that is prone to sepsis that causes the problem. Do you think that's a fair way of putting it, Peter?
I do, yes. And it often isn't the bugs themselves, is it? It's the toxins they produce, and certain bacteria are more likely to produce toxins that then, as you say, produce this immune response that can affect the tissues in the body. So it's quite a complex thing. I was reading a paper where they were listing all the different toxins that can be produced, and my head was certainly swimming by the end of it.
And I think Streptococcus is the biggest culprit, isn't it?
Yes, Strep pyogenes and Staph aureus are one and two, apparently. And Staphylococcus aureus is the one that normally just gives us boils and pus and things like that. Streptococcus, I think it's more Streptococcus pyogenes than Streptococcus viridans, which is the ones which give us sore throats, isn't it? but yeah. the gram negatives as well, especially in urinary sepsis. And maybe we need to talk about a little bit about urinary sepsis, because that's quite a common variant of sepsis, isn't it? Yes. Again, difficult to spot.
And urinary sepsis, particularly in older people, is a very common problem. So somebody may have a urinary tract infection, which normally would present with pain whilst passing water. You may have blood in the water. You may need to pass water more often. Some people may get back pain, as the urine infection can affect going up to the kidneys. But if that then gets into the bloodstream and becomes sepsis, older patients quite often don't have those first symptoms to warn them that they've got urinary tract infection. So sometimes the first thing you spot is confusion. And we see this a lot in patients with dementia. So they become confused, and when you investigate, it turns out they've got a bacterial infection in their urine. But because they haven't presented with the usual symptoms of urinary tract infection, it can often just come out of the blue.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And you get this thing called diagnostic overshadowing, don't you, where somebody is already a little confused because of their dementia. They get more confused and you think, oh, well, it's their dementia getting worse. And it's not. It's infection. And if they treat it, they get back to having.
And that's the difference between delirium and dementia, isn't it? So delirium is a sudden deterioration in consciousness, understanding. And that's usually caused by an infection or something else that's affecting them systemically, whereas dementia is a long, slow progress that affects the memory.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good way of distinguishing. I don't know if you've come across this. I've come across this thing called PANS or PANDAS, which again is where in children, typically, they present with an apparent psychiatric problem, anxiety or OCD or something like that, but it's actually due to infection. You probably know more about this than me, Kate.
I mean, it's an evolving area that for a long time people were very skeptical about PANDAS, and they didn't really believe it. But it appears they get almost like an encephalitis picture, an inflammation in the brain caused by the bacterial infection. And if it's treated with steroids, the children can make a very quick recovery. But if it's not treated, you have children who seemingly have gone off the wall, as it were. You've become very anxious, paranoid, behaving very bizarrely, and all sorts of behavioural difficulties associated with it.
And again, very difficult for an ordinary GP such as myself to pick up. So again, it may take several trips back by a persistent parent.
Parents saying, this isn't normal for my child. And unfortunately, with all these presentations, they're presentations we see a lot in general practice, aren't they? Behavioural problems in children or children with temperatures and coughs and colds. They're our bread and butter, and it's trying to spot those odd ones that are different, which is very difficult.
Extremely, yes. David has asked, will there ever be a vaccine for sepsis? And I mean, generally, vaccines are better for viral infections than bacterial, aren't they?
Well, I mean, vaccines treat the causes of infection. So the virus that causes an infection, you can have a vaccine to stop you getting that particular virus. COVID is a really good example. They produced a vaccine that stops you getting COVID. It doesn't stop you getting other viruses. Whereas sepsis is your body's reaction to that infection. So you can't have a vaccination against sepsis, because sepsis is what your body's done when you've got the infection rather than the infection itself.
Absolutely. And you mentioned about how different people react. I mean, quite a lot of people, when they've had sepsis, get post-sepsis syndrome, very much like long COVID. A lot of the symptoms are very similar to long COVID. Is it worth saying a little bit about that? Because it happens in about 50% of people who've had severe sepsis, doesn't it?
Yes. And I mean, my personal feeling is the post-sepsis is similar to the effect of being on ITU causes a lot of long-term problems. People have post-viral syndromes. There are a lot of conditions that affect energy levels, ability to function physically, ability to think coherently. And I think we don't really understand these conditions enough yet to really, I think they're all going to turn out to be linked personally.
Yes. But possibly due to mitochondrial function, where there's some suggestions around that, isn't there?
Yes, or microglial inflammation is the other area that people suggest, of inflammation in the brain. There are all sorts of possibilities.
And again, important to stress, this isn't just older people who are affected. Okay. So a third of children get significant cognitive deficits following sepsis, don't they?
Yes. And like going back to the original topic of conversation, sepsis, it can affect anybody, any age. You know, as we said earlier on, there are certain conditions that make you more prone to sepsis, but fit, healthy, weightlifting 21-year-old men can get sepsis as well as the other groups. So it's not, nobody is completely safe from getting sepsis. Anyone can.
No, as I was in hospital, sort of just recovering and well enough to look at the news, that it was, I think, a 56-year-old, previously completely fit and well, female, who'd been on the news on television, died of sepsis, just died in his sleep. So it can affect everyone. So should we say a little bit more about the scoring systems? Because we've now probably alarmed everybody, and everybody will think, you know, even if they're just slightly unwell, I've got sepsis. So we need to put it in context, don't we?
I think it's important to remember that when you have sepsis, you do feel rotten. You felt okay to begin with, but the day that you had your IGORs and the day you went to minor injuries unit, you probably felt pretty rubbish. And you know, people do feel very unwell when they've got sepsis. And one of the symptoms people describe is this feeling of impending doom. When people have sepsis, that things are going to go wrong. And the main symptoms are usually a temperature. You can then, with the temperature, get shaking, which is what happened to you. You get the rigors. Often you can get cold hands and feet, even though you've got a temperature. Your skin can go very pale or even blue around. And if you look at children in particular, they can go pale and look blue around the lips. And if you can't spot those, as we said earlier, in people who've got black and brown skin, if you look at the palms of their hands, they can look very pale as well. You can have a racing pulse, feeling faint, not being able to stand up, being rather confused, and getting very breathless. And sometimes in small children, being breathless is the main symptom that you spot, that and the fact that they don't want to do anything. And if anyone who owns a small child knows, that's really unusual. So that's a good alarm system.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a specific subset of sepsis with meningococcal septicemia, isn't there? Where, again, you get altered cries and non-blanching rashes and things like that. So perhaps worth just saying a little bit about that.
Yes. I mean, certainly, I don't know about you, but when we trained, meningitis was a big scary thing that we were watching out for, and nobody ever talked about sepsis. That didn't seem to matter. So meningitis, meningococcal bacteria that get into the lining over your brain, so the meninges, causes severe headache, confusion. In children, they, as you said, they've got this odd high-pitched cry. They become very stiff. They often can't bend their heads forward. And they will then, the ultimate thing that everybody remembers is the rash. So it's what we call a non-blanching rash. On your skin, you get purpley, look like bruises. And if you put a glass on top of it, they don't go away. Whereas the rash of most childhood illnesses will go away if you put a glass on top of it. But that's peculiar to meningococcal infection, although you can get that rash, which is known as a vasculitic rash, with other infections as well when you're very unwell. It's usually a sign of damage to the small vessels in the skin.
And that's really clear, Kate. Thank you. I think people will find that helpful. Coming back to what you were saying about fear of impending death, as ever in medicine, we translate the obvious into Latin and think we're very clever. So angor animi is the medical term for that, isn't it? And classically, there are a handful of conditions that give it. Heart attack is one. I think dissecting aortic aneurysm is another, which is, as it has about an 80% mortality, is not surprising. Sepsis is another one, and I certainly had that. I had that feeling of, oh dear, I think I'm going to die. And having had flu and a very high fever, I felt unwell, but I never thought I was going to die. So I can certainly attest to that. I'd also add that having had COVID right at the beginning and had sat down in the sort of 80%, I had it with that as well, because I felt I was going to drown. So I've had it twice in my life.
Oh, dear.
But here to tell the tale. So I think if anybody does get that, it means they need to take it seriously.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Peter, thank you very much for sharing your story and allowing us to ramble around the edges of sepsis. Of course, it's a huge area. There's an awful lot more to cover. I hope we haven't frightened our listeners too much. I think it's very important, the emphasis, sepsis is not common, whereas common illnesses are common. And the symptoms, although they're difficult to detect, they are quite clear. And most clinicians, particularly now, there's been a lot of work done to help clinicians identify sepsis early. So if you seek medical advice, it's much better informed now. I think it's a much better condition to have these days than it used to be.
I'd absolutely endorse that and say the care I had in the NHS was fantastic. I must give a shout out to Minehead Minor Injuries Unit, who were absolutely brilliant in giving me very prompt and excellent treatment and doing all the right things. So that was reassuring that the NHS is so good at recognizing it and treating it. And worth mentioning, Kate, you've mentioned a couple of resources that are available. We'll put them on the show notes for people who are interested, because there's some really good resources out there, aren't there?
There certainly are, yes.
Well, thank you for letting me share my story. If anybody wants to contact us to share theirs, we're always glad to hear people's stories. And I'm hoping not to become a regular expert by experience.
I hope not as well. Keep well.
Thank you. Go well, everyone.
Go well.